when you need to know what's going on around the world. Stay with Weekends with Jason Olbourne on today's News Talk, TNT.
Welcome back to Weekends. I'm delighted that you can join me for today. It is a blockbuster. In the first hour, we had independent journalist James Roguski, who revealed in that opening of that interview that the very first article he wrote when he became a WHO investigator, if you will, was about a doctor called Shankara Chetty. If you can believe that, he said to send his regards to who is my next guest. Now, my question for all of you is, were all doctors created equal? Can a doctor still provide an opinion and therefore you can go get a second opinion? It was almost as if in the COVID era, that went out the window. In fact, an entire political party ran on the idea that they were going to restore the doctor-patient relationship. Now, can a doctor simply take orders from the government as to what they can use as if one size fits all? Is there only one cancer treatment? For example, is there only one way to cure a disease? What if that person is allergic to the medication? For example, antibiotics. There are people that can't take penicillin. They're allergic to it. There are people that can't have sulfur. They're allergic to that. So what do you do? Just throw them out and say, sorry, we've only got one medicine, therefore just get over it, and that's the end of it. So part of our discussion today with Dr. Chetty is going to be about his approach to COVID and how he could treat so many thousands of people successfully and still have the South African government go after him, literally, for saving people's lives. Well, let me introduce him to him now. Dr. Shankara Chetty is a medical doctor and biological scientist with over 30 years' experience in rural and remote primary care in KwaZulu-Natal, South Africa. He's treated 14,000 COVID patients without one hospitalization or death. Dr. Chetty's breakthrough treatment in COVID-19 early intervention, outpatient management, was a game changer for COVID-19 treatment. Here he is now, Dr. Shankara Chetty. Welcome to Weekends.
Thanks for having me, Jason. And welcome to all the audience viewing us today.
Look, it's so good to have you on the show and for taking your time out in this morning, South African time. Dr. Chetty, when you look back at the last 4 years and you compare it to your entire career, can you even compare them, or are they two separate eras altogether in the medical profession?
I think over the past 30 years odd, Jason, medical care has changed. It has become far more dominated by the governing bodies, by the pharmaceutical industry. So yeah, I've seen that happen, but I've been fortunate enough to be isolated 40 k's away from the nearest medical care in a town called Port Edward. So I spent the last 20 years practicing my own brand of medicine and actually keeping away from the influence of the big pharma industry. So all I get are reps that drive down 40 Ks to come detail me on medications, but I tend not to follow that narrative. We've got old medications that I know the benefits of, I know the risk profiles of, and I tend to stick to the older stuff that I'm confident with.
Now, something that bugs me with modern medicine is how it is that a doctor can follow a protocol given to them, even if those results are lackluster, like we saw with COVID, such as ventilation, for example, such as remdesivir as a treatment protocol. And yet these same doctors willing to go down that pathway were unwilling to look at your success rate with early intervention and COVID treatments, whereas your primary focus seems to have always been of saving lives, to which you have a perfect record in COVID. Why are doctors so oblivious to this work, and how did they stop the research proponent of their job?
I think, Jason, it's something that's crept up on us over a few decades. Like with COVID, the compliance was sowed using fear. And the same things happened with the medical fraternity. Over the past 30 or 40 years, the regulators have overplayed their hand, admonishing doctors for every little thing. We've had a patient population that does not want to take responsibility for its choices. So it's resulted in a whole lot of unnecessary litigation against doctors. And so doctors have become cautious, and it's easy to just defer to a higher authority with a protocol in his hand rather than think for yourself and get into trouble. And I think that's what's happened over the past 30 odd years. I think what people need to remember, if you look at all the different fraternities that exist on this planet, the medical fraternity is the only fraternity that can legally give you something that will kill you. And that can be, you can have a, you can, that can be negated simply by legislation, taking the necessary risks. So I think the medical fraternity for a long time was targeted as the forerunner in instigating this propaganda that we see now.
Now, if we go back to the beginnings of COVID, and we saw on the streets the famous scenes of people collapsing in the street, it's hard to believe that people would feel symptoms of flu and just happen to go wandering in the streets and collapse. What was your reaction in the very beginning as to what was going on? Did you believe it? Did you think it could just be a flu? Or were you just, as a doctor, going, okay, we've got a big problem here, let's roll our sleeves up and work out what's really going on?
Okay, from the first clinical pictures we were seeing from Wuhan and the sudden collapsing of people on the street and the rest, it seemed very strange. If you are unwell, you tend to isolate yourself at home, try and stay in bed. You know when something is going to go wrong and you take necessary precautions. So it was unusual to see these people dropping down on the street. But what that showed me was that there was something occurring that was very quick and aggressive and caused a sudden decompensation that seemed not to be noticed by the patient. They suddenly took ill and didn't realize how ill they actually were until they collapsed. So yeah, I was looking at the illness from that perspective, a sudden dysregulation that went unnoticed by the patient itself. We knew that we were not going to get good information out of China. So I waited for this to spread to another part of the world so that I could get decent information. And I found it strange that when we found the first cases in Wuhan, the Chinese managed to isolate that and not allow the virus to spread anywhere else in China, but seemed to strangely leave their international borders open so they could spread around the world. And I found that strange. You managed to contain it in your own country, but didn't care about your international borders. When it got to Italy, there were two things that happened. They brought up the genome to look at the PCR test. And of course, looking at that genome, I noticed an insert, an unnatural insert in it. And so straight away realized this was probably cooked in a lab. And then the second thing I noticed that was strange, the same pictures that were coming out of China, them spraying trains and sanitizing and the rest, were exactly the same pictures displayed in Italy. You could see the Chinese writing on the trains, and it seemed to be marketed as if it was filmed in Italy, you know? And so I noticed that, look, there's some underlying propaganda going on here. And of course, with the understanding of a lab-made virus, I knew there's an agenda immediately.
Now, this is something that's fascinated me from the very beginning. And when we were told that there were 8 non-random mutations in the genome, suggesting or virtually proving that this was made in a lab, at that point, Dr. Chetty, did you bring this up with any of your colleagues? And if so, what was their reaction?
Jason, I'm far away from other medical care, and I have very few colleagues that I actually collaborate with. A majority of them are specialists that I refer patients to if I can't do what is necessary. And so, yeah, it was something that I kept. I knew that we're dealing with the lab-made virus. I knew that the world's not ready to hear this. No one would believe it. I have a background in genetics, and in 1990, I was looking for a job in genetics. And of course, the lab in North Carolina was one of the choices. And at that point in time, they were already looking into genetic warfare, gene warfare, how to actually develop viruses and bacteria that could infect and develop the necessary vaccination so you could target a population very discreetly. And of course, I was aware of this research going on. I lost touch with it. And suddenly, in 2020, it was in my face again. And I suspected, yeah, there's some nefarious agenda. Yes, I had to keep it to myself. I knew that there was a plan out there when they told doctors not to treat, not to see patients. I wondered why you'd do that. You know, you got an unusual virus and you need to figure it out. So understanding the illness and the death is vitally important in saving lives. The mechanisms to which people get to that death is vitally important. And they tried to hide it. We weren't allowed to do autopsies, and, you know, that kind of thing. So I knew there's a nefarious agenda. I tried to mention it to people, but I saw the reaction. It was disbelief. And so I kept quiet about it. I think it's only when humanity is ready for the truth that we can express it. Otherwise, we talk into a wall. And so I just did what I needed to do to try and figure it out.
It's just incredibly disturbing, isn't it? So no autopsies and no treatment. Now, in Australia this week, there seems to be an explosion of mainstream articles exploring long COVID, which many people are expressing a link directly to vaccine injury and asking the question, why aren't unvaccinated people presenting with said long COVID? And of course, this is being swept under the carpet. One person presented me with statistics from a Canadian study that suggested that more people were getting long COVID who were unvaccinated from this particular Canadian study. And I found that odd. But then again, we've seen so much propaganda and manipulation of science and retracted studies, etc. And so I'm tracing it back to Dr. Zev Zelenko, the late doctor from New York, who was also very well known in early COVID, treating high-risk patients pre-vaccine. And he had a protocol, and I believe it's very similar to what you also came up with from the point of view that he said, or he asked his patients who presented with normal symptoms, and he would ask them simply, have you lost your sense of smell or taste? To which if the reply was yes, he said, well, you're going to test positive on a PCR for COVID. And my suggestion is that we put you on this preventative protocol, which was the zinc and the vitamin D and a zinc ionophore, whether it be hydroxychloroquine or quercetin in places where it wasn't available, and then on azithromycin perhaps after 5 days. So this was what we've come to know as a standard protocol that stops the zinc stopping the replication of the virus, keeping the viral load low, etc. Now, he also boasted an incredible success rate amongst high-risk patients, and he said only the high-risk patients are the ones that are put on this protocol. And he was asked about it, and he said, out of 3,000 patients, we only lost three. One was a cancer patient's terminal. One other was quite elderly. And he said, and one other we can't explain, just simply we lost. So whilst your record is even better than that, when looking at it and this early intervention or lack of treatment, is the lack of treatment at this case another one of these deliberate obfuscations of reality that has caused immeasurable harm to millions of people?
Yeah, I would say so, Jason. Seeing that I've been through so many thousands of patients and not had a death is reason to justify early treatment. I've also trained doctors around the world, and I've seen the successes that they've had. And so from understanding those successes, you chart a path forward. Now, just to put context to what we're dealing with, under normal protocol, when a patient became breathless, they were isolated at home, and they were told that if they got critically ill, they must get to hospital. That patient that got to hospital was in multisystem organ failure because of the reaction left too long. The doctor in hospital wasn't aware that it was an allergic or hypersensitivity process that triggered this reaction, so he wasn't sure how to treat the core or the basis of the reaction itself. And so patients progressed into ventilation and demise. The use of remdesivir or antivirals in hospital was absolutely nonsensical, simply because the patients that presented were presenting with an immune dysregulation and not a viral illness. The virus was long gone. So all the hospital protocols to kill a virus and all the hospital protocols with PPE to protect doctors was nonsensical, absolutely unnecessary. And I think the hospital protocols both were poorly understood. And I think with PPE, it created a distance between doctors and patients. So the patient was no more an individual. You were looking at them through a mask and they all became the same thing. There was no individuality left. And that was the purpose of masking, to take away our identity, make everyone look the same, treat them all the same. And of course, the flip side of that is to look at recoveries and speed to recoveries and what difference early treatment made. To put context, a patient with a saturation of about 70% would be hospitalized, sedated, ventilated, and trying to get that oxygen saturation up. And of course, 4 out of 5 patients in hospital died on the ventilator with that kind of presentation. Now, the very same patient in my setting that came to me with a 70% saturation and got treatment had their oxygen saturation returned to 100% within a day or two. Now, that's a drastic difference from what was happening in hospital, and you cannot ignore that. So when you look at the benefit of early treatment, I think it needs to be looked at in that light. At the end of the day, it could have negated all the mortality and morbidity of COVID illness. I've had patients critically ill with severe comorbidities, and they've survived this. So I don't think comorbidities played a part in it. I think the biggest contributing factor was withholding early treatment from patients. Because if I can have patients that are diabetic, hypertensive, obese, and elderly present with very severe COVID and turn them around within a day or two, I don't see the need for the hospitalizations. In fact, I trained doctors in a country called Meghalaya. I trained the ICU staff, the specialists in the first round. And within a few days, I got a call back from the biggest ICU in the country, the specialist running it. And he said, look, with instituting this methodology, I've negated 3 out of 4 ventilations in my ICU. Now, if outpatient treatment can negate 3 out of 4 ventilations in an ICU setup, one, we're using the wrong protocol in the ICU in the first place. And secondly, if you can turn an ICU patient around so quickly, they shouldn't have been in ICU in the first place, you missed the boat. So they actually called me back to train rural doctors so that they could catch these patients a lot earlier. And as soon as I trained the rural doctors and got them informed about how to actually manage this timeously and aggressively, we dropped the death rate from triple digits to single digits, all in a period of a month.
Such an incredible story, and yet it's such an obvious story, and therefore we're dealing with some form of manipulation, wizardry, if you will, from what must be seen as a clandestine agenda. And we're going to explore that after the break. But before we do, for all the latest community events, rallies, marches, festivals, and fundraisers happening near you, then visit the What's On calendar on the TNT website at tntradio.live. Stay in touch on today's News Talk TNT.
TNT's Alex Zaharoff-Roy.
They need to expand the number of places and countries that can make ARM-powered processors. And Intel has actually made chips designed with ARM designs for years. This deal will give Intel's foundries, two of which are being built in the US at a cost of $20 billion, more chips to make. Now, TSMC has received $6.6 billion from the Biden administration towards its much-delayed 3 and 4 nanometer chip foundries in Arizona. So while we went from a drought of chips during the pandemic, the second half of this decade should see even more chips being manufactured than ever before, which the world will need considering the AI boom currently underway will need ever more computing power to satisfy the ever-growing demand.
Talking Tech with Alex Zaharoff-Royt on today's News Talk TNT. A better business tip from TNT Radio. News Talk Radio listeners are some of the most active and involved listeners of any format. TNT Radio listeners rely on TNT Radio often as their primary source of information. They trust TNT Radio and are highly engaged with the content. If you'd like more information about advertising on TNT Radio, simply fill out your details on our contact page and we'll be in touch. To find out more, go to tntradio.live. If you're still wearing a cloth or surgical mask around in public, you're guilty of spreading COVID misinformation. It really is that simple. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Well, I'm glad you can join me for today's edition of Weekends, and my guest this hour, all the way from South Africa, Dr. Shankara Chetty, who technically is paying the price by the South African government for being too good at his job. Just quickly, Dr. Chetty, if you can fill us in on the latest in your legal battles with the government over your profession.
Okay, what's happened, I, early on in the pandemic, instituted a methodology of treatment based on what I was observing and the understanding of the underlying science. During that treatment, I realized that spike protein is a pathogen of COVID illness. and so started speaking out against spike protein. Of course, that drew attention to the vaccines that were coming up. And so I spoke out against the vaccines itself, saying that was a very bad decision to try and use a pathogen as a ground-based product to actually stimulate an immune response. In doing that, I had a professor here in South Africa that's the head of a large medical training institution, put a complaint against me to the Health Professions Council, saying that I'm not doing what's best in the public interest or for my patients. I am calling this a bioweapon and spreading misinformation about the vaccine. I'm making outlandish and implausible pathophysiologic claims about the way COVID actually progresses and causes illness. And of course, using treatments that were off-label and not sanctioned and recommended by the relevant regulatory authorities. I responded to that quite clearly, stating that I see no benefit from the vaccine and the harms are there to see. I clarified my pathophysiologic stance on the vaccine, on the virus and how it causes injury. And I justified my treatment, saying that I saw the patient and I think that the labeling of the disease was wrong in the first place, that this was not a viral pneumonia. And if it was labeled a viral pneumonia, the unlabeled medication was incorrect and it saw all the deaths. I labeled it as a hypersensitivity pneumonitis. And for my diagnosis, all the medication I used was exactly on label. So I don't see the problem with the medication I used. I don't use other people's diagnosis to treat my patients. Of course, they didn't see fit to accept that as a relevant response. They had a committee hearing, at which point they resolved that they should charge me. The charges cover those particular points that I've spread misinformation, called it a bioweapon, didn't do what's best for the public, the pathophysiologic claims, and of course the treatment. They brought these charges against me. We had the first part of the hearing where we had a committee oversee this counsel and myself. And of course, we initially raised an objection before we got going with this. It all centered around a video that I had done. It was at a Zoom meeting for a Caribbean summit where on the third day I was asked to summarize with other doctors. And of course, there was this talk about the nonsensical nature of the public health interventions. And I made a comment that if you understand the agenda, it all will make sense. But if you think it's for good health and health care, then it's not going to make sense. And someone asked what the agenda is. And of course, my conscience got the better of me. And I thought, well, it's about time I tell humanity what I think. And of course, I mentioned that I think that spike protein is the most elaborately designed poison man has ever made. And of course, it's meant to kill billions without you ever recognizing you were poisoned. And I went into in-depth understanding of the science, how it will kill, how it will cause disease and damage in such a plethora of different ways that we'll never pin it to a poison, how it will kill in different time frames for different people and would never look back and say, well, that's the event that triggered this, how it will exacerbate pre-existent conditions and justify the deaths because of those pre-existent conditions. I explained all the side effects from cancers to immunomodulatory problems to the clotting issues that we'll see to Alzheimer's, dementia. I went into the science in a 10-minute video that someone clipped, and it went viral around the world, and that's the reason I'm in court today. But every single thing that I stated on that video has proven to be true, and so they can bring it on. Look, the way I see it, I've been censored, I've been banned, I've been silenced, I've been hidden away from the public so that nobody hears about my work. So it seems the only opportunity I will get to speak truth and have the public listen to me is if they charge me and stick me in a court where censorship is not allowed. And so I look at this as the best opportunity to eventually be heard. And if they drop the charges, I'm going to give them something else to charge me with if court is the only place I'm allowed to hear my voice to be heard. So, well, now we sit in court, we've raised the objection. The objection is that the charges are not supported by the relevant regulations and cannot carry the charges. And the second thing I objected to was that in that video, I stated very clearly that it's my opinion. I live in a constitutional democracy where my freedom of speech and expression is protected by my constitution. And so I challenged the jurisdiction of the council to limit my freedoms of speech and expression. And if they choose to see their jurisdiction, I will approach the High Court to get an opinion on that matter first, before we proceed. The council came back with a judgment stating that I'm correct, that the law that they use cannot support the charges. And of course, it is my prerogative to seek the High Court. But I left them a loophole to allow the prosecution to go back and reformulate the charges correctly and come back for a fair fight. So the counsel, in their judgment, stated that they'll give the Health Professions Council, the committee, give the council 15 days to reformulate the charge sheet. But I expected they'll reformulate the charge sheet based on the original complaint and the recommendations of that preliminary committee hearing. The Health Professions Council went back and came back with a new charge sheet overnight. The new charge sheet states nothing about that video. It has no bearing on the original charge. It now takes the whole of 2021 into consideration. And of course, they've fine-tuned the four charges to cover the issues completely. It looks like the prosecution went back, listened to their witnesses, and decided to formulate charges according to the evidence they have in their hand. With these new charge sheets, it's almost like we're dealing with a new charge completely. So that means I need to look at the legality of what's happened. I need to also look at the relevance. I need to relook at my witnesses. How are we going to defend the new charges that are there? So we've been adjourned to the 12th of August for me to make those choices. I think that the council, thinking that it can go back and rehash charges on the same event, is illegal. It's bias against me. And I can use the new charge sheet bias to approach the High Court to show prejudice against me and have the matter seen in a High Court. I'd prefer it seen in a court of law so that my witnesses' testimonies become court record. And I'd like to address a whole lot of biases before we actually go into a case. And I think those biases can set precedent for cases around the world going forward. The three biases I'd like addressed, Jason. One is the conflict of interest of all my accusers. They must declare the conflicts of interest and so that we can investigate it during the trial so that I know on whose behalf they're actually talking from. The second is that the public seems to be a victim in my case and my accusers seem to be talking on behalf of the public. And so the public has an interest in this case and should be allowed access to proceedings. And then the third is a bias, a confirmatory bias that hasn't been addressed in cases and I think is vitally important in any vaccine-related case going forward. We know that the propaganda was there to sow prejudice, and it was done deliberately based on vaccine status. The prejudice was institutionalized, instigated, legitimized. Police were actually forced to enforce it. Today, brothers and sisters don't talk because of that vaccine-related prejudice. So we've got a population of pro-vaxxers who have become pro-vaxxers because of propaganda, not because of good science. And these pro-vaxxers are willing to prejudice the rest of the world, calling all of us anti-vaxxers if we decide not to take this particular vaccine. And of course, instigating fear by saying that we will kill people, we will harm those around us by not taking the vaccine. They limited our freedoms, weren't allowed to work, weren't allowed to fly, weren't allowed to travel. So all those restrictions were instigated by a pro-vaccine lobby that was propagandized. And today, that very pro-vaccine lobby that has instituted the prejudices is going to be judge and jury over my case. And I think that's biased. I'd like any jury formulated to be in equal parts vaccinated and unvaccinated to eliminate that vaccine-related bias so that we can have fair trials going ahead and come to the truth. I'm not going to have a jury that's made a mistake in taking the vaccination, except that just to allow me a win. That's bias. And I think we need to address that before we move forward.
Can I ask you, in terms of your legal understanding and strategy, how did you become so beautifully eloquent in that address? Is it simply the experience? It's almost as if they took away your title as doctor, you'd automatically become an incredible legal strategist.
I think at the end of the day, Jason, it's about protecting people's rights. Let's put it this way. We're a young democracy. I grew up during apartheid. I knew what it was not to be free. I knew what it was to be confined in different areas. I spent my youth fighting against that. I was part of the student movements in the 1980s that disrupted the apartheid government. I've been arrested many times for taking part in illegal gatherings. So I know what it is to stand up for your freedoms, and I know what freedom actually means. I think the over-regulation has taken away our freedom. So I think the freest country in the world is the one with the least regulation. So at the end of the day, a true democracy would find it very difficult to make new laws, but very easy to take away those that are not relevant. Today, we have the opposite. We have democracies where laws are irrelevant but still remain, and we keep making new ones every day. So I can't see how that enshrines our freedoms. And so I think with that understanding, with that experience growing up, I'm very protective of my freedoms and the freedoms of people around me. I've also, for the last 20 years, practiced in a town, Port Edward. Port Edward was one of the most racist towns in South Africa. During apartheid, I wasn't even allowed into this town. I couldn't even walk into the town itself. 20 years ago, when apartheid had already ended, I decided to set up a practice here, and I was the first non-white in this town. So I went through all the prejudices and racism. But with care, understanding, compassion, I changed the community. And today we're a multiracial community, and people understand each other and they respect that we can live as a diverse community, but protect our securities and protect our freedoms. So this is one town in South Africa where my son can go skateboarding in the middle of the night and no one will attack him. And so we protect our security very well. And so, yeah, I've been instrumental in changing prejudices, seeing prejudices, understanding division. And so when COVID came, immediately I realized it's an aim to divide people based on a new kind of apartheid. We're no more dividing and dispensing prejudice and propaganda based on race, ethnicity. Now we'll do it based on a vaccine status. And of course, a vaccine status is changeable, unlike your race and your ethnicity. So I can give you privilege if you're vaccinated, and I can call you unvaccinated if you don't take your booster and take away your privilege. So now I can change the dispensation of prejudice and privilege. And I think that's what this was about, to divide the world on something that can be managed, something that can be changed. And so that's where we're at. And I saw it from the start. I realized the prejudice and I kept my eye on the ball. And I think I understand how the legal framework works. I've been a mischievous child, Jason, and I've gotten out of a lot of trouble in my life. So I think I know when trouble rears its head, and I think I know how to get out of it. So, yeah, I think I've been primed for this job.
There is no question that you were born for this moment and other moments to come ahead of us. And I'm reminded of how many people would refer in early COVID as medical apartheid. Even here in Australia, it was a term that was bandied about, and especially when there was a 10-week period where the vaccinated were allowed out into society and the unvaccinated were meant to be locked up for a further 10 weeks as if that was going to do anything. The cases already started to rise with the vaccinated out in society at that point. So we then learned in real time that it didn't prevent transmission whatsoever. And so by letting the unvaccinated out at a later stage was just one of these ridiculous events in, by the way, egalitarian society where we're all meant to be treated equally. This was the exception to the rule. There's a term that you called pro-vaxxer. I've since developed the term from my own perspective as absolute vaxxer, somebody who believes in vaccines absolutely, almost as if it can't be criticized, it can't be scrutinized. And no matter what happens, it's always a perfect form of medicine. Even when it fails, the people who are absolute vaxxers will not see it, will not care, and not look at it in any way, not critical whatsoever. And it disturbs me that that's the case, that that people are that far removed from this scenario. It's horribly bothering. Now, you've painted a beautiful picture of life in South Africa and the work that you do that many of us have only ever seen in films, even when it may have been Mohandas Gandhi in his wonderful film from 1982, his early days in South Africa before he returned to India, or, of course, Nelson Mandela and the many films that we've seen telling his particular story. Were these men inspirational to you in your period of growing up?
Yes, definitely. Definitely they were. I've grown up in a family, Jason, that was very involved in politics at the time. My dad was in Salisbury Island University. it was a tertiary school at that time, for where non-whites could enroll. And he was in the generation of Nelson Mandela and Billy Nye and all those stalwarts that ended up on Robben Island. My granddad pulled him out of college because he was involved in politics and realized that he was going to end up in jail. And so a few members of my family managed to avoid that. And of course, politics then became a taboo thing in my family because we were going to get arrested. When I got to college and I started taking part in all the demonstrations and the rest, Mandela was a big part of that, instigated that move to actually force us to stand up for our freedoms. And of course, my family refused to bail me out each time because they said they sent me to college to get an education, not to get involved in politics. But we have a lot of inspirational figures here in South Africa. But of course, there are those that took the limelight and inspired others to stand. But I think we rose as a country. And I think it's created a lot of the problems we have today, in that the leaders that rose initially in the grassroots struggle were sidelined by the ANC. And today what we have in government are not the true struggle heroes. They are people that left the country, went into exile. It was the population of the country that fought for our freedoms. And when we received our freedoms, just handed it back to the ANC. But they weren't really involved in the struggle on the ground itself. And so today we sit with a government that's really not in touch with the feelings of the population. And of course, I guess another fight's in hand.
It never ends. And one who's born into a lifetime of appreciating politics, despite the fact that there's always the temptation to retire, I don't think it ever really happens. It's just one of those things that we're all born into. Now, we're going to take a break. And when we come back, I'm going to switch gears because I'm going to ask Dr. Chetty what he sees as the real agenda, what is the big picture, and if he believes that there really is a resistance and what that means for all of us. You don't want to go anywhere. This is Weekends with Jason Olborn here on TNT.
While serving in Afghanistan, I was hit by sniper fire. The fighting was so intense, the medevac chopper was barely able to land. In the hospital, I was given a 5% chance to live. It's a good thing math wasn't my best subject. Today, I visit classrooms and share my story. I talk to kids about dealing with life's struggles. I tell them, with a little help and a lot of work, that you can overcome any challenge.
DAV helps veterans like Adam get the benefits they've earned. They help more than 1 million veterans every year in life-changing ways.
I know that some struggles are big and some are small, but they're all struggles, and you have to learn to get through them. With support from DAV, more veterans like me can live their best life. And as a new father, I have one more reason to keep on keeping on. My victory is being there for the next generation.
Adam Alexander, may your victories inspire many more. Support more victories for veterans. Go to DAV.org.
I'm Belinda, and this is Willard, and we were adopted in 2021. When we first met Todd, he was singing a song, and I was like, wow, look at this kid with the biggest smile, and he has a big heart to match.
The energy you give Todd, you get it back from Todd.
Yes.
Todd's a joy.
Yes,
Todd's really is a great joy.
I love him. You and you.
Learn about adopting a teen from foster care. You can't imagine the reward. Visit AdoptUSKids.org.
Discussing local, national, and international issues. Weekends with Jason Olborn on today's News Talk, TNT.
Well, I'm a little bit selfish in this regard. I am enjoying today's show immensely, and this particular interview is something out of the box, and I hope that you are too. Now, we are with Dr. Shankara Chetty, who has painted a picture of how he worked out from the very beginning that we were dealing with something that most would never accept, and that is that something very, very sinister was at play. Dr. Chetty, what do you think is the big picture behind this COVID man-made virus and a one-size-fits-all solution that fits no one at all?
I think with the last 3 years, Jason, of the work that I've done, with the reactions that I've seen from the world around me, with understanding the intent of the people in control, looking back historically at how we got here, why we're here, what has happened to humanity, how has medical care been corrupted, what's the purpose of it. Looking at all that, I think we're dealing with a global Luciferian agenda that has almost started centuries ago, and this is the culmination of many years of manipulation. Now, we've quietly allowed it to happen, and suddenly when it's gotten to a point where it's going to manifest in all its forms, we awakened. We suddenly got to reality. So COVID was an initiating event. It was an initiating event for a bigger picture, a huge picture that touches on the economy, education, healthcare, politics, our social structures, food security. It touches every facet of our human existence. And it's the aim was to manipulate that. The aim was to enslave, to make sure everyone follows the rules and regulations of these unelected, unrepresentative private clubs that claim to be for the best interest of humanity. Now, when I look at that, we've got a group of people looking to control and take over the world. We see that clearly. We know the players. We see the oligarchs that are invested in this. And I think they have a far more sinister motive than we see. Depopulation is only one part of what they're trying to achieve. We've seen climate change. We know about them manipulating the economy. We know about CBDCs. We know about social credits that they want to bring in. So when I look at it, there's far more than meets the eye. So I think we're dealing with a spiritual agenda, something that humanity needs to come to terms with because it's going to affect every single thing around us. And I think part of that, Jason, our individual part in it needs to be clarified very carefully. Not all of us are here to fight this fight. Not all of us need to fight this fight. But all of us need to be aware of the fight so that we can take the necessary measures to protect ourselves. And I think that's what we need to do. We need to understand where we fit into the grand scheme of things so that we can make a difference going forward.
It's a profound statement that you've made, and incredibly inspiring for those of us that are toiling away on a daily basis, fatigued, distraught, lacking results and wondering what it's really all about. When you consider that you can't get a political solution to a spiritual problem, part of that understanding both starts to appear in front of your eyes to realize that there's something much, much bigger at play. I'm so concerned that people can't see that there can possibly be that power and authority could be an ultimate negative push onto humanity the way that it is under a satanic agenda that many people don't quite get. I see atheism as the gatekeeper of Satanism, the idea that people believe in government and not God, and therefore they can't see that this agenda is, as you said, created over centuries, that's permeated itself into all rooms of power everywhere where it exists. And therefore, that the resistance must come from a spiritual perspective. And what I've noticed in the 5 or 6 years leading up to this event and the 4 years since is that every day more and more people declare publicly their belief in God again. And this is something that was snarled upon a decade ago. It just never came up. It was just, sort of put aside. More people attending church, more people reading Bible, more people asking these questions. And of course, the reaction here in Australia on Monday when Bishop Mar-Mari Emanuel was stabbed in his church in what was considered to be an act of terrorism has again drawn attention back to this. Now, there's a lot to unpack in all of it, but when you go through your political component to your life, your scientific and academic component of your life, and clearly now a spiritual component of your life, do you share these equally, or does one sort of get to the top of the pyramid here in how you conduct yourself on a daily basis in your life today?
I think, Jason, there's no question about it. It's the spirituality that trumps everything. At the end of the day, we're all guided. I think we're part of a bigger picture. We all intermingled as fields of energy, influencing each other. And I think science is limited by our five senses, our understanding of science, and there's far more to that. When you walk into a room, your eyes see two people talking. Your ears hear the conversation. But how do you know they were talking about you? Your senses don't pick that up, but you know it. So there's far more than that meets the eye. And I think we lack that curiosity to go and investigate these kind of things. And I think that's where the solution lies. If I had to give my opinion or understanding of where we at spiritually on a global scale, right? To connect with the divine from a scientific perspective, you are given a power by God. And that power is to radiate energy to everything around you from the day you're born. That radiation is in the form of vibration. And that vibrational frequency is determined by your emotion. So if you are angry, you are radiating low frequency vibrations. That will influence the people around you. It will also influence the epigenetic expression of your DNA. And that will give you a particular state of health. If you are ecstatic, happy, you're vibrating high frequency. That will influence the people around you and influence your DNA and your state of health. Now, this is the power you have to influence the energies around you through emotion. Now, if you're not in control of your emotion, then someone's controlling the power God gave you. So the most important thing is to be in control over your emotions so that you're in control of the power God gave you. Now, to put context to that, high frequencies perpetuate themselves. Low frequencies tend to need to be energized all the time to keep them sustained. Now, if you walk into a room and there's four people sitting all glum in that room, they're radiating low frequency energy and they're keeping Lucifer's drumbeat going. But you have the ability to make all of them smile and change that frequency. And that's the power God gave you. But you need to be aware of your emotions to actually do that. So when we look at the power God gave us, we need emotional control to actually be able to use it. And part of that emotional control is to connect with the divine. The only emotion that gives you the right frequency that makes your DNA resonate. And in that resonance, gives you the necessary power of God, gives you the necessary eternal youth, and allows you to connect with the divine is bliss. So if you can manifest bliss, you connect with the divine. So everyone praying, everyone meditating, everyone doing yoga is trying to find bliss. And if they find that bliss, they'll connect with this divine power. Of course, we also have divine knowledge. How does a lion know to catch a buck by his throat? He didn't go to university to figure that out. Divine knowledge shared it with him. But this knowledge will be only shared with you if you're willing to receive it. So if you look at the space in front of you, Jason, it's full of energy. But it's got electromagnetic waves, radio waves, quantum waves, things that you can't see. And this is the extent of your reality. But God gave you eyes that only see so much. And you base your reality on that. He'd like to show you this extent, but he might break your brain. And so he's got to be cautious about who he shows what to. And so you're not supposed to see everything and you're not supposed to hear everything. Depending on the framing of your brain, it might injure you. And that's why I say, when it comes to humanity, each one of us have different parts to play, depending on what we can tolerate as reality. Now, for him to show you the complete reality, you've got to be insatiably curious. Your curiosity must never be shackled by your own ideas, opinions, prejudices. It must be completely innocent. And of course, it needs to be absolutely fearless. When he shows you, you go look. So if you have a fearless, innocent curiosity and a control of your emotion, then you'll be able to control your spirituality and the power God gave you to influence the world around you. But the world is full of distractions to capture that emotion and make sure it resonates at a very low frequency. So when you look at the cabal, we talk about all these players that are causing havoc around the world. Their job is to cause havoc. They must cause war and division and destruction and food shortages and political divisions and upheavals and economic crisis. Yes, there's a depopulation agenda, but it's not to kill you. It's to make sure that the entirety of humanity feels sad and despondent and depressed and hopeless. And when we do that, We radiate negative, low-frequency vibrational energy, and Lucifer smiles. And he wants us to remain that way. So the aim is to capture low-frequency emotional energy. And that's what powers the dark forces. When you look at child sacrifice, we've heard a lot of adrenochrome and the sacrifice of children and pedophilia and child trafficking. The reason that this happens is it's not the sacrifice of a child that satisfies these dark Luciferian forces. When you look at emotion, the emotion that radiates the lowest frequency is terror. So when you feel terrified, you are radiating the darkest, lowest frequency energy to everything around you. And of course, you disconnect from the divine, so I can get you to jump off a cliff in that fright. Now, the aim is to torture innocent children to the edge of their lives. And when an innocent child, blessed with high frequency vibrations at the start of that life, feels this overwhelming emotion of terror, they radiate the strongest, darkest, lowest frequency energy known. And it's that emotional energy that Lucifer wants. The dark forces are powered by it. And that's the reason they do what they do. But I think it's important to realize that you can get the world to smile, and Lucifer doesn't stand a chance. I think what we need to realize as humanity to make sense of where we are, your ability to spread joy in the world is challenged just by two things. It's challenged by your senses, and it's challenged by your circumstance. And your aim here on the planet is to maintain those good vibrations through your life in spite of your senses and your circumstance. Now, if you look at the way a child looks at those things, he never gets involved. Now, just to I think, Jason, let your audience know where we need to go if we're going to find some understanding. My journey last year was to a mountain called Mount Kailash to figure out how do we lead people to Noah's Ark. He never stopped the flood, and I don't think my journey is about stopping this flood. It's about trying to show people how to save themselves. And when I looked at the two things you need, bliss and a fearless, innocent curiosity, where do you find bliss? Look at a newborn baby, blissful. And where do you find a fearless, innocent curiosity? Watch a toddler stick his hand into the dog's mouth to see what's in his throat. So what that tells me is that you were blessed with the two things to connect you with the divine from the day you were born, and as well given a high frequency vibrational output to maintain through your life from the day you were born. How did you forget? And I think we forgot the day we grew up. The day you grew up is the day Lucifer took your hand and made the world's problems your problems. It was never your problems. I think we need to go back to realizing that we are children of God. We are not conceited, opinionated adults of God. And he said he'll take us back as his children. So the problem is, we grew up. We were meant to remain children till we die. And I think part of this act of growing up and becoming adult or adulterated is losing our innocence and connection with the divine. So everything from schooling to everything expected of us from society is meant to grow us up, take away the inner child from us, and disconnect us from the divine so we can be easily manipulated. So at the end of the day, our salvation lies in finding the child in us and going back to being fearless, innocent, mischievous children that are not distracted by our senses and our circumstance. When a child walks into a room and sees two people and hears them arguing, he walks out. He goes and distracts himself with play till he hears laughter to come back. So he never lets his senses influence his high vibration. He looks away. He knows how to look away. He knows how not to hear. Blindness and deafness is not a disability, it's a blessing. When a child, even in war, children play. Even in famine, children play. They know how to play and ignore their circumstances and not let it influence their vibrational energy. So why do we ask why Lucifer does what he does? We were not put here to fight him. And when we ask why he does what he does and get involved in that narrative, then we give him the ability to distract us and control our emotion. So if you look at something that causes distress to your emotion, look away. Be the child and walk out the room. It wasn't meant for you to fix. Those of us that can look dispassionately at what's going on around the world, let us fix it. You just make sure the energy you put into the world is not negative in all its entirety. When I look at humanity, I think we need to realize we're just balls of energy, conscious energy floating around the universe as spirits. And our consciousness allows us to manipulate the energies around us. And then God looks at Jason and decides, I need to test this man's frequency out. And so he gives you birth on earth as a fearless, innocent, mischievous child that can keep in contact with him. And he blesses you with a high frequency output. And he tests you with five senses that are very limited. And he allows Lucifer to do a dance around you every now and then to change your circumstance. And those are two tests to see if you can maintain that high vibrational frequency through your life and maintain contact with him. And if you allow circumstance and senses to affect you, then you're always sad and depressed and despondent, and you allow life to take its toll. And then God looks at you and thinks, geez, I sent him there with high vibrational frequency and he couldn't maintain it. So when he dies, send him back. He'll need another journey through this. But if Jason realizes that he's an innocent child of God and nothing actually is his fault, and his aim through life is to stay connected and stay happy and make sure that he spreads good vibrations to the world around him, then he doesn't let his circumstance or his senses influence him. And so he's always happy and making people around him happy. And when God looks at him, he thinks, well, he's a trustworthy powerhouse. He's always giving off high vibrational energy. When he dies, send him to me. I can keep him as a backup. And that's how we negate the cycle of birth and death. And people need to understand that, but that's what this war is about. Everything around you is a distraction to control your emotion.
We have to go, Dr. Chetty. I'm sorry we had to cut you off, but that is the most magnificent interview ever.
Thank you.